Welcome, everyone, to our presentation today on In the Hot Seat, Tips for Advising the CEO and the Board. My name is Stephanie Lambert. I'm a lawyer with Staples here in Boston, and I'd like to welcome you all on behalf of the Association of Corporate Counsel. We have a rather unusual and unique program. We are bringing together the Northeast chapter of the ACC and two of its global networks. One is called the Law Department Management Network, and one is called the Corporate and Securities Network. So we have a live program as well as streaming to those networks globally. I'd like to thank Morgan Lewis, our host today, and I'm going to turn this over to Jason Franks. But before I do, I'd like to encourage folks to join our social media sites. So we are now in the Northeast on LinkedIn at ACC Northeast, and we are on Twitter at ACC Northeast. So with that, Jason, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Welcome everyone here tonight to Morgan Lewis for our program. We're excited to have you. As Stephanie mentioned, I'm Jason Frank. I'm a partner here at Morgan Lewis in securities litigation, and we appreciate you taking the time to come here and engage with us on such a nationally news-charged evening. Hopefully we can distract you a little bit from the news of the day with some things to think about your professional lives as opposed to our collective public life. Let me introduce our distinguished panelists. To my right is Brackett Denniston. Brackett is the former general counsel of General Electric, and he's now senior counsel at Goodwin. To his right is Kathleen Patton. Kathleen is currently the general counsel at CarGurus. And last but not least, we have Jeff Levinson, the general counsel from NetScout Systems. And with that, let me just describe briefly what we're going to try to do here today. We wanted to talk to you about what it's like to be in the hot seat, and in particular, in the hot seat as the general counsel in a circumstance that may require an internal investigation. We plan to do that through discussing a case study, and I think that everyone here may have been handed a copy of the case study. We've also provided it to our webinar participants online. We're due to have about 150 webinar participants, so please excuse me as I try to ultimately juggle questions we might get from the live audience and also from webinar participants. And I guess what I'd like to do is I'll quickly read our case study, it's fairly short, and then engage in a discussion with the panelists, and then we'll welcome questions from our audience, both the live audience and folks participating online. All right, our case study. ABC Software Corporation manufactures and sells cutting-edge cybersecurity software. It is a public company that Wall Street has valued, based in part on its strong and continuous revenue growth. As in many companies, management pushes its salespeople to book as many orders as possible before quarter end. The salespeople receive bonuses based on the dollar amount of orders they book. To achieve management's objectives and earn their bonuses, certain salespeople have allowed customers to enjoy lengthy trial periods, make payments over time, and even enter into questionable barter arrangements. For one reason or another, the company's finance department missed or otherwise ignored these arrangements. In some cases, finance was not aware of these issues. In others, they appear to have been aware but booked the revenue anyway. The company's outside auditor approved the accounting treatments at the time, but it too was sometimes aware and sometimes unaware of these issues. The company's outside auditor, however, has since revisited these historical accounting treatments. It has begun to ask finance questions about these issues and the company's business practices. If questionable accounting treatments are of sufficient magnitude, the auditors may refuse to opine in connection with their audit that last year's financials fairly present the financial position and results of the company. In addition, the auditors may require restatements of prior period financials. The bogus sales may have allowed ABC to report sales well above analysts' expectations, thereby artificially inflating ABC's stock price. After speaking to the outside auditor, the CFO of ABC brings these issues to the general counsel's attention. The GC had no prior knowledge of the accounting issues, but the CEO was previously the senior vice president of sales and marketing. The GC does not know whether the CEO was involved in or otherwise aware of these issues. And with that, we'll use that as a case study to start our discussion. And so, given that the title of our program is In the Hot Seat, I will start by putting Mr. Levinson in the hot seat.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Jeff. So what are the first things you do? CFO has come to you and told you, I'm getting questions from the outside auditor. What are the first steps as a GC that you take?
Well, thank you, and thanks to everybody for being here. Appreciate being a part of this, particularly for all the people who have logged in and made this sort of an interesting interactive event. So I think about this in two ways, just to set the table, Jason. One is context, and two is framework. So with respect to context, I think all of this, these scenarios will have context around it. And what I mean by that is you need to know the players. You need to understand your company. You need to understand sort of your risk calibration and sort of what you've done historically, how you think about these types of issues. And the reason is you're going into this with an approach where you want to be calm, poised, not make any assumptions. And to do that, you really need to understand the players, and you need to understand your business really well before you can start diving in and doing the fact-finding. And then, so that's just a brief sort of what's the context here. And then I just made this up while I was sitting here, so I wrote my initials here. As you think about the framework, here's how I would think about it. The investigation needs to be timely, robust, independent, confidential, and scaled. Unfortunately, that is tricks. Timely, robust, independent, confidential, and scaled. And those are just at a high level how I would start thinking about this, and we can all talk about what those mean, but to kick it off, that's where I would go.
Well, that's great. And so you initially think immediately, okay, we've got to conduct an investigation. But as you're thinking that, who are the first people you call? So let me turn it to Kathleen. So you get this information, you're thinking along the lines that Jeff's thinking, I need an investigation, it's got to be timely, robust, all of the things that Jeff mentioned. But before you put together the investigation, or in connection with putting it together, who are you communicating with?
Yeah, so to be honest, the first person I call is my husband and tell him dinner plans are off and, you know, we should probably think about the weekend as well. So I think I've spoken with the CFO, I've sort of gotten the information I've needed from him. I then turn to my CEO. I think I would speak to her for sure. I'd want to be in the room for that conversation. Whether the CFO comes with me to have that conversation, the context is really important, understanding the relationship among the parties. But certainly I need to walk into the CEO's office and get her attention right now and say, hey, we've got an issue here that's likely to lead to an investigation. If it's likely to lead to that, it needs to be timely and robust, and we need to start thinking about how we're going to frame this. So part of that conversation, in this case, I'm going to recommend that we reach out to the audit committee chair as well next. I think in our case, he. She's now a she. My audit committee chair is now a she. She'll need to sort of be involved now and sort of figure out how we communicate to the audit committee. But I do think in this case, the audit committee is going to play a major role. So once we've spoken with the CEO, I want the CEO or me to reach out to the audit committee chair and start that ball rolling.
And so once you've reached out to the CEO and the audit committee chair, what are the factors that you, well, let me turn this to Brackett. Who's going to conduct this investigation? And who makes the decision who conducts the investigation in your view?
Well, let me preface it by saying the moment that this lands in your lap, you're responsible. And that means in all of the most hazardous ways for lawyers, responsible to the SEC, responsible to a prosecutor potentially. And you have to guide your behavior by very high standards so that you and the people that you work with don't get into worse trouble. Because that's what often happens when you get into a restatement situation. Everything happens in a hurry, and then people make it worse. So you don't want to make anything worse. I think you have to find out a few facts yourself, even before you brief the CEO. you're going to want to talk to the CFO who's brought it to you. You probably have a controller. You're going to want to talk to the controller. And if it's me, generally general counsel should have good relationships. I'm sure we all do with the auditor. You're going to go get the auditor's viewpoint a little bit before you go see the CEO. So you come armed. But you're going to recommend an investigation. And who should do the investigation? If you're talking about a restatement, trying to do it yourself is a loser. That's going to get nowhere and should get nowhere with the audit committee unless they're asleep. So you're going to have to go get somebody external. And you're better off getting somebody that's not connected to the company rather than going to your usual outside counsel, because you're going to get into that kind of weather. So I think that's a more debatable choice. If you have really good outside counsel that you trust, you may start with that, but you may have to pivot because you're going to get lawsuits. You're going to get lawsuits down the road. Some people might argue, well, do it internally. I wouldn't do that. You might take the initial steps internally, but not more than that. And then there are one or two other things that I think often get overlooked when something like this lands in the lap of a general counsel: trading. You got a trading window open at the time. It may be that nobody who knows about the potential restatement is going to trade, but if somebody in the company does, even though they don't know about it, you're not going to be able to defend it. So think of Equifax. And what happened when it was weeks before they actually closed the window. And the general counsel traded, I think. So you got to close the window, and maybe you got to close the buyback too. Though the risk for a buyback is less, since you're buying it at a likely inflated price, it's still as stupid to have a open buyback.
So you raise a lot of interesting issues. And so let me go back to where you started, and then maybe we'll walk through some others. So one is finding out what's going on. In connection with finding out what's going on, are you concerned that you're turning yourself into a witness, and do you issue Upjohn warnings when you talk to some of the people who may have been involved?
I don't think, in my opinion, the general counsel shouldn't be in the usual course issuing an Upjohn. What you're doing is preliminary fact-finding in a privileged context. You could always become a witness, but what you're doing is getting enough facts that you could actually give informed advice rather than starting the whole machinery. And you're going to have somebody outside, preferably, who's going to do most of the fact-finding, but you can't operate without knowing something of the facts, because the facts will be critical.
And
by the way, one other thing, you're going to have to issue a document hold pretty fast.
Yep.
So I was just going to add to that. Not only do you try and understand who is part of this so you can do a document hold immediately and just freeze that, but also this is a point where some people are starting to panic. And they think, you know, the world is about to collapse, and you have to be the voice of reason and calm and say, we need to go figure out what this is about. Now, in the fact scenario, the fact pattern we're looking at here, it's pretty dramatic. But we all get these, and I'm sure everybody here in the room and online, every day you're standing at your desk, sitting at your desk, somebody comes in with one of these, and you can't make presumptions. You can't make assumptions. You'll see it, say, an FCPA type issue or something, and a lot of times there's a good explanation. And so you don't want to be too disruptive. You want to be robust and intense. But I try to go in without an assumption that somebody has done something wrong. It's, I need to find out what happened first. And you have to do that quickly before you get, you may be at yellow, orange, going up to red. But before you're sure it's red, you need to be thoughtful about how you get there. But you don't have a lot of time.
And so let me throw this out to the panel generally. What are the factors that you consider as to whether or not this is only yellow and maybe can be conducted internally, or red and needs to be conducted using outside counsel? What are those factors?
I mean, in this case, in the hypothetical example, we've got a potential
restatement, which I think is material, and I think that sort of pushes us over the edge towards we ought to treat this as a material issue. But I think generally if it involves misconduct by senior executives, alleged or, you know, in that case, I think that's something where I'm going to take it very seriously and elevate it. Or if it's something that's widespread, or something that could get into the news, those are the sorts of things that I would sort of say, hey, let's freeze this and figure out how we want to approach it rather than, you know, we, as Jeff said, we get things every day that come across our desk where we say, thank you for raising that issue, we'll take a look at it, and we'll get back to you. And, you know, half of those we probably turn over to HR and say, go look at this and come back and let me know what happens.
Right.
Exactly. But when legal is involved, I think it's, you know, something where legal at the general counsel level even, I think it's something where senior executives are involved or it's a widespread issue or it could involve something that's going to be disclosed.
I think Kathleen hit it well. I'd look at what internal resources do I have. There may be some investigations where I have internal auditors and a litigator with some experience doing investigations who could do it. A lot of investigations done that way. So I'd say complexity, what internal resources you have, and do you need, as Kathleen said, do you need independence in order to bolster the credibility of what you're doing?
And
independence and expertise.
Yeah.
And because one thing you're going to want in your outside counsel is somebody who knows the accounting standards.
Absolutely.
And they can actually go toe-to-toe with the auditor. That matters.
I was just saying, not only expertise, but, you know, sometimes, again, maybe outside of this particular fact pattern, if it's multi-jurisdictional, it's very hard to handle internally, whether it's because of law or language or whatever. But here, I agree, you need the expertise that you probably don't have in-house, at least for most of us.
And who's the client internally that you select or you work with others to select to conduct the investigation? Is it the audit committee? Is it a special committee of the board of directors? How do you go about making that decision?
I don't like to jump to special committees because that assumes that your existing structure is flawed in some way. And it's also harder to do. So if you need a board committee, the audit committee is perfect for this.
Yep.
As long as they don't, you know, they're not involved in having made some sort of accounting judgment themselves, that's part of the investigation. So I would go for the audit committee. Well, lots of investigations don't need a committee at all. But at least in my experience, we reported at GE, we reported all investigations of any significance to the audit committee. But we do it at different levels, and they wouldn't necessarily manage it unless it was a restatement situation where they would be much more involved.
So let's
successful committees are rare. Sometimes you got to do it.
So what are the circumstances where you would say you got to do it?
For me, well, in this case, it's a financial matter, so I do feel like my audit committee is the best committee to address it, and they're independent, so I think that's where I'd start in this case. But if for some reason there was some connection between an audit committee member and the thing that we're investigating or the person who might be involved, you know, maybe they have beach houses next door to each other and they're really good friends or something, somebody at my audit committee, maybe then I'd consider a special committee. Or if it's something that's just outside the expertise of the audit committee, you know, maybe there's a better group of people who could come together and investigate that. But I'm sort of with Brackett that I think that's kind of their job.
So think about a Me Too investigation. You wouldn't want the audit committee doing that.
Right.
That might be a special committee.
Yep.
I mean, there's probably a comp committee or something that might be able to do it, but that's probably something you want a special committee on. It's significant.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think the audit committee is the right place. Are there things, Jason, you're thinking of where you, in your experience, special committees have been helpful or required?
Sure. I think that if you added to a little bit to the fact pattern, you got a shareholder demand letter. You knew there was derivative litigation coming. You wanted to do your best to protect the corporation against, in the context of a derivative demand.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it would be advisable to put together a special committee so that you can pick those directors who are independent and disinterested and better insulate the company. I suppose there could
Why
be a whistleblower.
Not the audit committee?
Well, it depends.
Whenever I got a demand, I would kick to the audit committee.
I suppose it depends exactly what the shareholder demand says, but usually these shareholder demands imply that one or more of your directors are interested or lack independence. And if you can hand pick those who are unassailable in court, it can just make the life of your friendly neighborhood litigator easier. Now, in addition, you might have a situation where you have a whistleblower who is saying something about board members, and I suppose in a circumstance like that, you know, where you say, oh, we brought this to the attention and it was ignored, I suppose in a situation like that, you might consider a special committee as well. Okay, so you've chosen your internal client. It's going to be the audit committee for this investigation that relates to the restatement, and they go about choosing outside counsel. That is the lawyer for the audit committee. How do communications work between the GC's office and that outside counsel?
How do you mean, how does it work?
Well, are you getting regular reports from the outside counsel that's conducting the investigation, even though their client isn't management, their client isn't the company, their client is the audit committee?
I mean, you're definitely in a supportive role, certainly, right? You're going to be making introductions and making the connections and making sure they're getting the documentation they need. So I think you're definitely in a supportive role. I think you'd like updates, but without sort of, I think I'd be requesting updates just so I can understand, you know, are we going to have a disclosure obligation here? I need to keep my ordinary corporate counsel in apprised of what's going on so that we can prepare if there's something that we're going to need to do in terms of a disclosure or something else. So I do think there's communication that will continue, I would expect. I'm both in a supportive role, but I'm also receiving information from them as the investigation progresses.
I mean, I think I would try to be more aggressive on my side, and that would be if the audit committee wants to bring in separate counsel for this that's maybe not the usual corporate counsel. First, they're probably going to chat with me a little bit about who that should be,
mm-hmm.
Because that's my area of expertise, and I'm going to have some recommendations. And they'll vet it, and then they'll select. But I think they're going to be looking to the general counsel, that's my opinion, to help manage the entire project. So while the investigation needs to be independent, I want to make sure that I know what's going on for all the reasons Kathleen mentioned, but also because somebody's got to manage it, and I don't see the audit committee doing the day-to-day operational management.
Mm-hmm.
They will be... they're responsible and they're the ones who are hiring that counsel, but they're not day to day saying, oh, you know, you need to do these interviews. Well, that's a little extreme, but who do you need to talk to? How do you do that? So I'm going to be probably a little more aggressive pushing my wind to make sure that we're managing it from our side.
I wouldn't say I'd be running the investigation, but it would be reporting to the general. Now, that is the way I did it, and I think it worked fine. But at the same time, giving that counsel plenty of private airtime with the committee.
Yeah.
Private airtime with the committee, so they get comfortable with each other. The only time that I wasn't as much involved was if you got in a derivative situation, you got a demand, and you're trying to make a record that's a little different there. And then that counsel would have more direct interaction with the chair of the audit committee and the audit committee itself. But I would hear every time they would call me and say, here's what we're going to say.
And keep in mind that they'll conduct the investigation and then we'll talk about what the outcome of that investigation is, whether it's a report or something else. But we're the ones who have to live it and implement it, right? We're the ones who need to say thank you for your conclusions, and now we're going to decide how we're going to implement changes or whether we terminate someone or, you know, so there's, it's, the report is in the investigation is in the end, it's just part of the process. So we need to know what's going on.
Now, I may be heavily criticized by my partners for asking this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What do you do, if anything, to control costs associated with the internal investigation? Jeff?
Again, the hot seat. Look, in this situation with the restatement, that's probably the least of your worries. You're really not going to be focused on that so much. You do want to make sure that you trust and have a good working relationship with the outside counsel so that they're doing what they need to do, but they understand that it's not, you know, it's not open checkbook. It's, you need to be thoughtful about how you do the investigation. And scoping the investigation goes back to the question we were talking about earlier, when general counsel or your designee, you know, head of compliance, whatever, is involved in those discussions, then there's back and forth, how do we scope and scale this whole thing? Because you don't want it to be, oh, we found a small thing and now we're going to go interview everybody in every jurisdiction. You need to really make sure that it's a thoughtful plan. But for a restatement type thing, you're going to be spending a good bit of money. For a smaller scale thing, I think you can work through to what's the appropriate level. And the other way to manage it is get it done quickly. When they drag on, you just spend a lot of money. But the quicker you can get these things done and you can drive your outside investigators, forensic people, counsel to a very quick resolution and you're on them all the time, that really helps bring it to closure but also control costs.
I think if you've got a committee that's involved, you've got to get their buy-in first. But that's not going to be hard, but you don't want the outside counsel saying, I was constrained because Denniston told me I couldn't spend any money. That's not going to do with the committee, so you've got to have their buy-in. But I think it's perfectly legitimate to say, give me a budget, give me a flat fee, move fast, give me bills on such and such a basis. I'm not going to pay. Some companies have policy, I'm not going to pay for first year. So all those things that you normally do for cost control, you should do.
Now, you mentioned, I think Jeff mentioned consultants. So in cases, in a case like this, you can imagine needing forensic consultants. You can imagine wanting other audit, you know, other accounting firms involved, assessing what the company's done, the audit decisions that were made. To what extent do you hire folks like this? To what extent does it get outsourced to the law firm? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on the situation you're in. In the case of our hypothetical example where it's an accounting issue, there's a material issue that's been raised for likely restatement, and your auditors may have known, could have known, should have known, I think you definitely want to engage an outside, you want to encourage the audit committee to engage, some outside expertise on that. There's all sorts of privilege issues that goes around with that, so it really should be engaged by the attorneys who are representing the audit committee, and you'll want to consider that. But in this case, I do think it's worth the money. You don't want to be in a situation at the end where your auditors are pointing fingers at the company, and I think this, in this case, it warrants hiring outside expertise.
I think a lot of times we're seeing also when you have to do email searches and document searches, it's likely you're going to hire some sort of forensic electronic firm. It just helps you, right? It helps you make sure that you've ring-fenced this type of thing. Sometimes you have to look at, in this case, for example, you might have to look at your CRM system. There's a lot of stuff to look at. You're probably not going to have internal expertise around that. So you may want to, as Kathleen said, engage through counsel some other experts that could be helpful to understand the scope of the problem and start getting at the answers.
First of all, I'd say that normally in a situation like this where you're dealing with a financial issue, potential restatement, you want the auditor to be your friend and not your adversary. And so you're going to want to rely on the auditor to a substantial degree. And when I say the auditor, that means I don't just want the lead auditor on my engagement. I want the national office of the firm involved, and I'm probably going to want the chair of the firm. It depends on your size and your ability to ask for that, but I generally would want both the chair and the national office heavily involved. But again, you're trying to not have a fight with them. You're trying to have a constructive relationship. I'm not in favor in most cases of going and getting a forensic accountant. I'll come back to an exception. Generally, if you've hired the right lawyer, either you already have that, I said this earlier, or you get somebody who's your outside counsel who has a lot of experience in, say, revenue recognition, if this is a revenue recognition case, they can get in the face of the auditor, as can the general counsel, and debate it. Thirdly, though, there are some areas that are so technical, that are so different, that this is just RevRec, so it's not that technical. I had a restatement that involved derivatives. The derivatives standard is this, I'm serious, it is this thick. It is the most complicated accounting standard in the world. And we were debating issues. Our internal accountant said we accounted for derivatives correctly. The outside auditor wasn't so sure. So we did go get somebody who was an expert in derivatives accounting to try to help us persuade the auditor. And that so in some cases, yes, it makes sense to get an outside. And there's one other dimension to this case. There's a little tension here. The auditor, in your hypothetical, the auditor knew of the booking in some cases, which suggests the auditor may have some exposure itself. And that may drive you more to what Kathleen said, which is you're going to need somebody on your side.
Now, who's interfacing with the auditor? Is it you? Is it the CFO? Is it both of you? How do you structure that, if at all?
I whenever I had this kind of situation, I wanted the CFO to be right with CFO and the controller. That's a larger.
But
I definitely did everything in complete tandem with the CFO.
So talking about people who may have been involved, may have known about things that were going on at the time, in our hypo we have the possibility that the CEO, he was the head of sales, so she was the head of sales in our hypo, and the GC is uncertain about their knowledge. What, if anything, does the GC do to learn more about the CEO's knowledge? Do you just outsource that, or do you ask the questions yourself, and how does that affect your communications with the CEO?
It goes back to me, the original principles, which is I'm not making assumptions at the start. I have a relationship with the CEO, I should, as well as with the directors and the CFO and other people. And I think you have the conversation. What is this? Can you explain this? Now, I don't know what this is yet, but I think you have to open the conversation, start asking questions. I don't think that's a hard conversation to have, because a lot of times you're fact-finding and the individual, in this case the CEO that you're talking to, may have a lot of knowledge, a lot of information that they want to share with you that could, you know, you could shortcut the whole thing, say, this is what we did and why, and here's how you should understand it. You can test that, but I think I don't think you go around or avoid that conversation. I think you have to have it pretty early.
How do you have it, though? Because it's, hey, boss, did you know about this stuff?
I think you do it in the context of the scope. You know, I think we come back to the scope issue quite a bit in a lot of these questions, right? So if we're assuming we're still early in the investigation, early in the process, I do think you need to have a conversation with your CEO and say, tell me about this. Like, how big is this bread box, right? Do I have an issue here? And at least hear her out and see what she thinks about it. It's not an investigation. You're not, you know, you're just trying to understand whether I ought to think there's an issue here or not. Ultimately, I may disagree with her, but I at least need to understand from her what we're talking about and how big it is. And, you know,
so she starts to tell you, and she has a eureka moment in the middle of explaining to you what happened, and she says, oh, hold on a second here. Is our conversation privileged, and do I need counsel? How do you answer that, Bracken?
I was asked that question quite a bit, not very often by my CEO. He would always tell me, you know, I have an honorary doctor of laws. I don't need my own lawyer. So jokingly, he knew better. But I said to anybody, look, if you want a lawyer, you should get one. We should help you get one. I'll never say no to anybody who wants a lawyer. Here are the considerations about when and why, and here are the options about who you might pick.
And what about the privilege question? Do you end up giving it de facto? So the CEO says to Kathleen, hold on a second. Do I need a lawyer, and is our conversation privileged?
Well, the answer is it's privileged, but the company owns the privilege.
Right. So you end up giving a de facto up-John warning, in a sense.
No, you're subtly saying that, look, of course it's privileged, but the privilege is controlled by ultimately the board of directors, not me. I never did get asked that question. The privilege is owned by somebody else. It would be an unusual CEO would ask that.
Maybe someone with a doctor of law.
That's the same. I would say to the CEO, that's the same rule everybody in this place lives by. Because the only owner is the entire board, and the board's going to make a decision about what to do with the privilege.
So after asking that, the CEO says to you, she says, well, I don't actually think I need a lawyer here because this isn't really a big deal. I don't think we need an internal investigation. Why don't you just stand down? I'll talk to the CFO. I don't really think that you need to pursue this further. What do you think, Jeff?
I find that troubling.
And so now, what do you do?
Now you're sitting there and you take a breath and you look at the CEO and all your thoughts are running through your head, your boss, and you're thinking, is my resume updated? And these types of things. And you say, I'm not sure what my next sentence is, but essentially it's the gist is not really your call, right?
I think the question is, tell me why I shouldn't think this is a big issue, right? I think that's the, you know, sort of diplomatic way to say, I think we need an investigation. You haven't told me anything that makes me think otherwise.
Right. I mean, that's a great way to get at it, I think. Ultimately, you may need to enlist allies and rely on your relationships with, it could be with a lead director, a chair of the audit committee. It could be that you have trusted outside corporate counsel who's with you and says, yeah, we need to do a little bit more to support, you know, in support of what you're saying, which is we need to do a little bit more. What you're really saying is we need to do a lot more here. It's a really challenging scenario, and it's tough, and it's troubling. But I think a lot of times you can persuade them, unless they're personally implicated, that, no, there are things we need to do because it protects not just the company, but it could protect the individuals involved if you go through and do it correctly.
Yep.
You have to try very hard, that both of my colleagues here are suggesting, to persuade the CEO that it's not a good idea. And that takes some listening. Why do you want to do it that way?
well, here are the other considerations. And this is significant. Lots of people know about it. There are people who could go to the government any moment about this, and it's just going to get worse if we don't control it now. For everybody, it's going to get worse. And offer, I think the idea of having somebody else talk to the CEO, get a second opinion. At some point, you're going to have to say to this CEO, if the CEO is still of that view, it has diplomatically as you can, well, you know, I can't stop because I have a legal obligation under SEC rules to elevate an issue like this to the board. And so we're going to have to take it to the board, and the board will make the ultimate decision. You don't want to say that until you positively have to.
That's right.
By that point, the CEO is saying, how do I get rid of this?
That's absolutely. Right.
So the board, so the CEO stops fighting with you, and she says, okay, I understand you have to pursue this. But she also shares with you facts that indicate she was involved. She directed the accounting treatment. She did the deals. How does that affect the investigation and your actions going forward?
Well, I think it depends to some degree on how heavily implicated that makes them. Did she know about all of it? Did she bless violations of accounting?
She did, Bracken.
Okay.
She did it.
And then you're going to have to say, we're going to work our way through this, but you're going to have to stand aside to the investigation. You're just going to have to let the investigation happen, and we'll make the best arguments that we can. We're going to have to disclose it to the audit committee. They'll want to deal with this issue. So to some degree, I think you want the audit committee to be the bad guy here in that sense. But you're just going to have to make the hard decision that the CEO is sidelined, recused in our fancy lawyer's language. And the best comfort you can give the CEO is we're going to investigate it. And if the facts don't lead to it being a violation, we're going to make the strongest arguments we can. You know, it's not, the reality is that the CEO who will tell you this is usually saying, well, I didn't mean it wrongly. Here's why I did it, right?
Yep.
There'll be an excuse. It's not going to be, yeah, okay, you got me.
I committed fraud.
I thought it was okay, and I asked the CFO, and the CFO thought, yeah, it's okay.
And he talked to the accountants, and the accountants cleared it.
Fuzzier than that. But maybe there's a few cases.
So let's say the CEO doesn't tell you that they were heavily implicated. Rather, it's our fact pattern that we've handed out and that I eloquently read. And you end up getting a phone call. You get a phone call from the top salesperson. Top salesperson says, I've got something really important to share with you. Please give me a buzz back. This is a voicemail you receive. Now, the investigation is ongoing. What do you do with that? Are you calling the person back? Are you starting to ask them questions about what happened? Do you turn it over to your investigators? How do you proceed?
I'm calling them right back.
Yeah.
There's no question. I mean, what do you have to tell me? I'm not worried about I want to know what they have to say. And sometimes when I know hypothetically about this and I know my company and how we do business, it's a little easier than somebody from the outside coming in without sort of the background. So I can help understand, you know, help the investigators understand, okay, this is this guy's role. This is what he told me. You need to go take it now because he's implicated or not implicated, whatever. But I really want to understand why they're calling me. And if it's somebody that I work with all these people, I want to pick up the phone and understand, you know, they're reaching out to me for a reason. So let's find out what that is.
Yeah, I would do the same thing. I think, you know, hey, what's going on? What do you know? Tell me what your concerns are. and, you know, as appropriate, introducing him or her to the people who are conducting the investigation. I think it's you sort of owe it to those people that, you know, he may be he may think there's more to this, or he may not be aware of this yet, or he may be calling because they just got a big deal and he wanted to tell me, and it has nothing to do with the investigation. So. But I would definitely talk. Again, I'm not going to interrogate him. I'm not going to have a list of questions for him, but just understand what his role is, what he understands, see if it's consistent with what I know about the investigation, and if I think he's got good information, introduce him into the process.
And these are people we work with every day. We have relationships with. I want to maintain those as best I can, and I also want to get as much information as I can. So if I flip it immediately to, oh, this guy's calling me, I'm going to have some outside people just, you know, cold call him back, I'm going to lose something there, and I'd like to make sure I get as much as I can up front.
And your head of sales isn't as used to dealing on a day-to-day basis with the general counsel, right? So he or she is a little bit more nervous about this process and doesn't quite understand his role, and so it's a little bit different. I think you've got to sort of help them a little bit more than you would, you know, your CFO and your CEO.
You know, I think we're all in agreement. You don't know how long the salesperson is going to be willing to speak candidly about something like this. So you're going to want to call back as fast as you can and then just listen. I'll tell a little war story. It's not an accounting story, but it is a similar situation. At GE, we had a whistleblower report that people had been falsifying inspection reports of nuclear reactors in Japan.
That's concerning.
That's fairly scary.
A little alarming.
But it was twice. This was by a former employee, and he said this had occurred twice, and we'd sent people over to investigate it, and particularly there was a guy who was a general counsel of the nuclear business, Harold Deems. And while Harold is over there, they did a bunch of interviews, and everybody said, no, nothing happened. And one morning, a person who had been interviewed came in and said, Mr. Deems, everything that we told you is a lie.
Hmm.
And we not only falsified inspection reports in the two instances which the whistleblower identified, we did it dozens of times over 15 years. Now, Harold didn't wait to listen to that. I got a call like about a nanosecond after that was over. And that, believe me, that was a call. I'll never forget. You just don't know, you know, when you have it, you got to get the facts. And
so let me tell you what this person said. This person called Kathleen, and Kathleen called him back, and this is the head of sales. And the head of sales said, so I got to tell you, I just heard from John Smith, who's selling widgets in Australia, and he told me that that he was aware of a side letter that did just what we're talking about here in terms of these accounting issues. And he told me that that he felt so guilty about it, he called the SEC. He's confessed to me, and we can expect to get a letter from the SEC momentarily. And you get a letter from the SEC momentarily asking about these questions. How does that change what we do, and what in particular impact does it have, if at all, on disclosure?
Well, it reminds me, that's a really good twist. It reminds me of something that you have to do pretty quickly in the investigation is stop the behavior.
Yeah.
So if somebody's come and told you that they're giving special contracts which allow people not to pay, you got to stop that right away. It goes back to that principle I said, the minute it lands in your lap, you're accountable for that. So you've got to stop it. But your question is more about what do you do now that the SEC knows, you know the SEC knows, and you're going to have to come to a quick decision.
A, are you going to go to the SEC?
Yep.
That answer is, yep, fast.
Yep.
And you're going to say, we've been investigating. Of course we were going to disclose all of it.
And you may, my policy, honestly, was very early tell the SEC, don't wait.
Yeah, I think once you know it.
If you have a reasonably strong belief there's going to be something, because even if it turns out to be nothing, that's not bad. But the other part of your question is, what do you do about disclosure? I think that's really hard and debatable. My own opinion in that situation would be it's not an obligatory disclosure. One. Two, if you disclose it, no one has a clue about how bad this is. Not a clue. You are out there with a naked fireball. And I've seen that backfire. So I'd want to wait until I could actually say something that sizes it and that doesn't lead shareholders to think that there's mass panic. But you can have different views on that. A lot of people have a regular practice. The minute they hear from the SEC, they disclose.
Yeah, that would not be my response either. I'd want it, you know. I think it puts more pressure to make your investigation complete still robustly, but really on a timely basis, so you can come to your conclusions and figure out what, if anything, you need to disclose. But the SEC letter itself wouldn't necessarily trigger disclosure for me, but it's certainly something I'd talk to counsel about, outside counsel about, and have a healthy debate around it. And then you've got now I know I have an employee in wherever he was, Australia, who is a whistleblower, and I think I'd reach out to him and send him a copy of the whistleblower policy and say we have a non-retaliation policy, and if anything comes up, if you feel any concerns, you know, be aware of the policy and make sure that he is taken care of as well.
Now, so you have a whistleblower, you have a disclosure issue. Now, this program's called, I know when we invited you, you thought it was going to be called In the Hot Seat because we were talking about your hypothetical GC. No, unfortunately, we're all in the hot seat here answering these questions, so let me make the problem even more difficult. So you have this situation, and your quarter has just has closed recently, and you have a 10-Q
yep.
that finance is finalizing and about to be filed, and now you have all of these issues. How does that impact what you do going forward and what disclosure you make, if any?
They always happen.
It always happens.
Right before you have to file, and you're running around. That's just part of this whole discussion. You're still, I think the analysis is still the same as what you said. It's sharpened because of the time pressure, but also in hindsight, people will say, well, you just put, you know, you put your Q out, you or whatever, and you didn't disclose this. Why didn't you? And so it goes back to what Brackett and Kathleen were saying about the investigation and how you consider about going to the SEC, but also the same disclosure issues. So I don't know if it changed. It puts more pressure on you. It puts more pressure on you because the board is looking at you, the auditors, you know, that's a question. You know, the other wrinkle is where are the auditors in all this, because mm-hmm. they're going to start asking you for your opinion position on it. And you have to be able to answer that.
Well, your auditors are going to have a lot to do with what you do. So they have to effectively sign off on the queue. And some auditors are just going to tell you, you better say something. And so as much, a hard part of this is what would you say if you had to, because you were forced to by them. But I would try to avoid it because you can't size it.
You don't know.
You haven't really verified it. It's very early. I don't think it's obligatory again. I don't think it's obligatory. And you're taking some risk, to be sure you are taking some risk, but you haven't pinned it down enough to be able to say this is inaccurate.
is what I would now be worried about too is, you know, as I hand the certs to my CEO and CFO to sign, them saying to me, am I okay to sign this? Like, should I be signing this? I think everyone's going to have...
Hard question.
Yeah, that's a hard question, right? What do you say? Because I know I get that question. Should I sign this? What do you think? So...
And how do you answer that?
I close the door and walk out. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's, again, facts and circumstances. If we don't know, if we're convinced disclosure isn't required at this point, if we know we're conducting an investigation that will lead us to a valid conclusion, then I think we say.
A lot depends. You know, the hypothetical doesn't say anything more than it's material. Is it barely material? Is it hugely material? That's going to have an impact on what you do in that situation.
Mm-hmm. And is it definitively material? It says
right.
You think it's material, but
material.
It may not be. And I think it is. I think to Brackett's point earlier, if you can't size it, you don't really understand the scope of the problem. It's really hard to go out with a disclosure that's vague, doesn't quantify it. That's sort of a disservice, too, because you're pointing people in the wrong direction. You may spook people. There's this big scary thing, but we don't know what it is.
But if the CEO is part of it, it's automatically going to be material.
If true, yes.
You have the quantitative and you have the qualitative.
Absolutely.
Right.
If that's a fact.
Then we've been talking about a scenario that's really high stakes for a company, and I appreciate that there are far more issues that arise than in-house counsel's offices, general counsel's offices, that are not so high stakes. So let's add yet another fact to our scenario. There's an employee in D.C. His name is Britt Kavanaugh, and Britt is accused of...
We're escaping.
We are. This is pure fiction.
Kavanaugh with a C.
With a C. And Britt is accused of sexual harassment. How does that affect this larger investigation? What does a GC do upon learning of this other problem that arises during the course of the investigation? Jeff?
This is what Kathleen said. This is one where I'm like, thank you, VP of HR.
Right.
This is yours.
Right.
You know.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Obviously, we would be involved in that type of thing, but I'm not sure why this would be part of this same investigation.
Right. So it's not part of this, and so how do you? So let's take a smaller scale investigation. What are the differences you observe between our large investigation and our small investigation? Who's running it, for example, and your involvement?
We're being a little bit glib. If it is something serious, I'm still going to be involved, depending on all sorts of factors, because I want to know what's going on and how serious it is, and is it pervasive, and should we, what have we done? What have we done to do the training on the front end? How do we remediate? Who's involved? So I'm going to stay involved as general counsel, but if it's an employee relations issue or something like that, I would probably get the HR team involved and have them either lead or co-lead with me.
Yeah, I mean, you could find out that there's expense reporting abuses or other things, right? That tends to happen when you start reading people's emails. And if we're talking in the context of the larger investigation, you should absolutely ensure that these investigations take place on the same timely basis they would otherwise take place, but not interfere with the overall investigation. And, you know, if it's expenses, then I'm going to get my internal auditors involved and HR involved and still stay in touch. Any investigation that happens in the company, I have an oversight role of.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any of these things that you're sitting there, you have a major investigation going on, and somebody comes in and says, I have something else for you. Okay, bring it on.
Yep.
You know, you're just going to deal with it as you do any of these. And you go back to what's the right scale and scope for this one. So I don't think there's any particular magic to that.
I agree completely with that. In a way, it's a relief from the other situation.
Yeah, we haven't talked.
I'm still worrying about what I'm going to disclose in the quarter.
One thing we haven't talked about is sort of maintaining the confidentiality of the investigation, right? We talked about closing the trading window. I'm going to try and make sure that as few people as possible know about this investigation going on. And really, I think that helps to preserve evidence. I think that helps to, you know, scope it. We could find out that nothing wrong happened, and we don't want people's reputations to be harmed. So one thing to keep in mind is limiting the group of people who are aware of this investigation. And depending on what your insider trading policy says, you know, alerting folks that you're now in a blackout or due to a widespread blackout or, you know.
Well, it highlights a point about what's the best kind of trading system, control system. If you just have the window is open and you don't have to consult with anybody, then you have to go out and issue something, which is going to alarm people, because you're not going to have a good reason. You can invent a reason. Who cares what?
Yeah.
But it's not going to be a good reason, and people will talk. You want a system where somebody actually has to come to you. And so the only people who ever find out have gone to you or the securities lawyer that you have and said, is it okay if I trade? And the lawyer says, well, no, we don't want you to trade now. There's some things going on. That's a better way to handle that.
So I want to open this up in a moment to questions from our audience, both live and participating by webinar. But before I do that, let's talk about the close of the investigation. So you've chosen the client internally. They're conducting an investigation. You're heavily involved in managing that with outside counsel that you respect and that has expertise in that particular area. And now we're getting close to the conclusion of the investigation, and outside counsel asks you the following question. How do you want this to close? Do you want a verbal report going to the audit committee, or do you want a written report? What's your answer to that, and what factors are you considering as you make that decision? Who's in the hot seat for this one?
So, if the conclusion of the report is that something inappropriate happened and we need to make changes, I think I would like a very high-level summary report that shows that an investigation was conducted, the board undertook its duties, we reviewed this, the scope of the review, and then just what the findings were. And then from that, we'll draw our own conclusions about next steps in remediation that we do. You know, do we be terminated? Do we have new controls? Or those sorts of things. But I do think it's beneficial, especially for some of the shareholder derivative litigation, to have some report that shows that you've conducted the investigation in a thorough and thoughtful manner and came up with them. I wouldn't have a fully detailed report, and maybe you can comment on whether those are privileged or not, or whether that, you know, is somehow discoverable or not. But and I also think, on the other hand, if somebody's being exonerated, you also want to say, hey, we looked at this carefully and we've decided that there's no there, and, you know, I think you want to record that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. I've seen both in different contexts, both ways, but also typically a report to the audit committee, which would be minuted and would be, at the appropriate level of disclosure, assuming that it's going to come out one day. I mean, I love attorney-client privilege, but you know, you have to expect that a lot of things will get exposed or could get exposed. So I think minutes are really important.
Yeah.
They need to show that the audit committee has directed a careful, thoughtful investigation. And as Kathleen said, part of that is what steps did you take as a company? And then I would also include some of the remediation in those minutes, but you don't want to get real detailed about it. You want to show that they did their diligence and they upheld their fiduciary obligations. I think that's where I would end up in any cases.
I generally would not want a written report because it can get second-guessed too much. I favor minuting it in an adequate way, but not a written report. The exception would be if there was an exoneration and you needed to use it for some agency,
purpose. I've never had a case in lots of derivative situations where you had to produce a written report in order to convince the Delaware Chancery Court to dismiss the case. So I don't think it's usually necessary for that. It's just the reason I feel that way is that the report can too easily get picked apart, mm-hmm. and it can too easily get disclosed in some way that you don't control. Facts will change over time, and that might undermine your report. Plus, by the way, it's going to cost about three times as much.
Yeah, sure.
The only thing I'll add to the discussion there is that I think that if you imagine taking this report that's initially privileged because it's an attorney-client communication, it's work product, and you're actually planning on sharing it, there are risks relating to subject matter waiver. And so not only have you just waived that report, but there are risks that you may waive other work product that's been created by the firm, for example, interview memos it took during the process. So it's a tricky issue, and I can understand sometimes companies wanting the written report, but I think minuting it is a good way to perhaps avoid the risks associated with the waiver.
The government, at least in the FCPA or DOJ world and the SEC world, they're so used to people coming in and just not giving them written reports. They'll give them oral reports, and it will be, here's what such and such a witness said. And they'll actually almost go through and read the memo that was produced after the interview, but they won't give them the memo.
There's a recent horrible case out of Florida where an oral report was given and a judge ended up holding, I think you've waived. I think you've waived.
I don't know.
So you got to be very careful. So I'm happy to entertain questions from our webinar participants and from the live audience. I don't know if we have a microphone in the audience. Oh, we do. So feel free to raise your hand, and we're happy to take questions. I'm happy to ask more questions. But if we have any from the audience, that would be great. Yes?
A hot seat question is partly
relevant to what happened today and what's still happening tonight, apparently. But in the corporate setting as opposed to the Supreme Court setting. So if you get an employee who gets in trouble for anyone or all of whether it's harassment or conflict of interest, expense report fraud, bribery, hanging out at KTVs with customers all night, and you confront him, admits it, you terminate him, and during the interview he says, hey, I don't know what the big deal is. 15 years ago, this happened all the time, everybody did it, including some people that have now been promoted, blah, 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 blah. You know, what are you going to do about that, right? You know, has anyone had, you know, how far, you know, CEO, to put you on the spot, CEO says, how far back do we need to go to worry about this stuff? Do we go back to the beginning of time? My company was founded in 1960. You know, do we go back to the beginning of time to uncover anyone doing something wrong 30 years ago still with the company? Do we not? Is it 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? Does anyone have any thoughts on that, if you put it on the hot seat?
Isn't it a 38-year rule, or was it 36?
You know, it's a really good question.
It's a really good question. I think I'd...
I'm glad you're answering it first.
I think I'd... consider it an investigation. I think there's an allegation that reflects on the, you know, I'm assuming we're talking about somebody fairly senior in the organization that reflects upon his or her credibility, and, you know, maybe somebody could, I think I'd start an investigation.
I probably would too. I think something depends on how serious the facts were and what the context was. You could just, you know, this nuclear situation that I mentioned, these things were 20 years old, some of them. And if it's at all serious, it has no statute of limitations. I mean, that's one of the lessons we're getting in Washington today.
Mm-hmm.
It no longer has
You can no longer defend yourself with saying that happened in high school or it happened 30 years ago, and that's just the way the sales culture was.
And at first I thought when you asked the question, I thought, this is a really tough question, but it's really not. I mean, I think the more I think about it, you're going to have to take it on. You're going to have to look into it. And, again, I don't like to make assumptions, but if that was happening 15 years ago, that behavior may mm-hmm. continue. So if somebody's saying, hey, I saw this then, if somebody's fooling with expense reports, they didn't do it just once.
Yep.
So I'm looking into it with the idea of I need to see how big this is. So I would look into it.
Good question.
You know, with this person who raises the issue, you're going to have a little persuasion to do too, right? But in other words, what's he getting or she getting for leaving? Because whenever you terminate somebody like that, you're going to end up with some sort of an agreement. And that may give you some comfort. But I still think you're going to have to investigate it.
Question for you. So tips for advising the CEO and the board, I'd like to flip it, tips for advising the GC. So one of you had said, as soon as you know, you are now accountable. So as you're working through that fact pattern and now you become aware that there might be a need for an investigation, if you were advising a GC in particular about, okay, writing emails about this, we've talked about communicating, I assume, verbally, but what would your advice be about putting things in writing once the CEO or once the general counsel has been briefed?
I use email, and if it's a privilege, I'll put privilege and confidential. So I mean, a lot of these conversations are conversations, and they're preliminary. And they start the investigation, so I don't think they're investigative notes, or any, at least at the start of this. So I'm not trying to document everything that was said up front. I'll have my own notes, but those are protected notes. So if it goes beyond that, then I think you have to think about how you want to capture the information and protect the information for privilege purposes.
I think it's a great question. I'll tell you my concerns that arise from it as outside counsel. I have no concern about my communications, or very little concern about my communications with my client if I were to represent an audit committee, for example, coming out. Those really should be privileged. I'm careful about them. For important, sensitive issues, I may prefer a phone call, but yes, there are going to be emails back and forth. What always concerns me is the internal emails I can't control. In other words, you may feel, general counsels may feel comfortable reaching out to a CFO and having a back and forth saying this is privileged as well. But it's then when the CFO reaches out to the controller and the controller reaches out to her team, it is those communications that where it would be much harder to defend. And from outside counsel's perspective, I think it's good at the outset of investigations like this to be upfront with your client about the need to try to keep sensitive information not in writing, but shared verbally. And if it has to be shared in writing, to take those steps necessary to try to protect it, to send it to the in-house counsel, make sure they're included on the email.
You know, in a sensitive investigation for an inside general counsel, there is a time and a place for a good memo. And it's not just for CYA purposes. It's also for accuracy purposes. It's also for CYA purposes. And for good reason. And for good reason. So I don't think it's routine. You don't need it routinely because you're living in a world where you're trusting most of the people you're working with. But sometimes you've got to make a record.
You're anticipating the memo explaining how communications are going to work?
Yeah, sure. In the course of an investigation, you're gonna end up thinking at various points in time, what do I have to do to make a record? For example, when emails were frozen, or when there's a document freeze, or when the audit committee is notified of such and such.
Yeah, when you became aware.
A record of some kind. It may be a minute. It may be
upset of charts, but it's going to be some. And you're going to want some of that around any investigation.
Let's talk about another kind of memo. You use the expression CYA. When does it, has it ever arisen in your careers that you wrote the CYA memo, that you were speaking to the CEO and the CEO made some disclosure and you didn't just pass it on to outside counsel, but you thought, you know what, I have to write a memo to file and document this, or I have to send an email to outside counsel and document this. Does that, have you ever, what are the circumstances under which you'd ever do something like that?
I never did with a CEO or CFO or anything like that, but I did on more than one occasion when somebody would come to me and say X, Y, and Z. It might be a set of allegations, but they would be situations where I was suspicious about the motives of the person and the facts that the person were conveying to me in some situations, and so I had to memorialize it to protect myself and the company.
And what did you do? You created a memo?
Ultimately, this happened a number of times, not dozens, but it happened more than a handful. I don't think one of them ever materialized in anything, but I was worried that it might, and that's why I made a record.
And what kind of record did you create? Did you send it to anybody?
No, I made a memo to my file. I don't know, on a few occasions I might have sent it to outside counsel.
Kathleen, Jeff, ever
the
no memos to file?
The only circumstance that I can think of were sort of in HR situations where a termination was sort of on the horizon, and I think I ended up sharing what was shared with me with the head of HR, sort of just to document it. I had a conversation with so-and-so today, and we discussed this. Those are the only ones I can think of. I didn't have, certainly no issues with CEO, CFO, that level.
Yeah, nothing like that.
Anything else from our in-studio audience?
That's a great question.
Yeah. Definitely on the hot seat.
All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone. We really appreciate you coming out tonight. And we hope we give you some food for thought for the issues that may arise in your own professional lives.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.